history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some folks around you who have stories to tell. If only you take the time to ask a few questions and listen, you'll be amazed by what these veterans went through. And we want our veterans to know that we appreciate their service and sacrifice, that we're not going to forget the price that was paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot, we're educated, we're entertained, so many times inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And so many of them bristle at the title of this show, Hometown Heroes. They tell us the heroes are those who never came home. And we're going to meet a gentleman today who knows a lot about those who didn't come home. Vito Mastrangelo, 92 years old, of Visalia, California. Your whole life in Visalia, California. You were born here. And this is quite a story. Both of your parents came here from Italy, and they met on the ship from Italy to America?
That's true. Very true.
You don't think that's just a story they told you growing up?
Well, you know, that's the story I heard, so I don't know. But I tell you, he fell in love right away because the first few years in Visalia, my dad, he told me he walked to Porterville several times. He didn't have a car or anything like that. A few years later, he bought himself a bicycle and pedaled his way to see my mom in Porterville, close to Porterville.
So that's quite a haul, just to see this girl he'd met on the ship coming over here.
Yeah.
You grew up, you and your brother, your older brother, Bert.
Right.
I bet you guys had a lot of work to do out on the ranch if your dad was growing raisin grapes and walnuts and things like that.
He didn't tolerate football. You came straight home from high school. There's always work on the ranch to do. We didn't have much of a ranch, but it was enough to keep us two boys busy. And he says, I don't want you breaking a leg. How can you do the work on the ranch if you break a leg? So we had to come home.
Mm-hmm. No sports for you?
No, none.
What was your relationship like with your brother?
It's a little bit, you know, there's always tension between brothers, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You think that he's getting the best part of the apple or something, you know, and you got jealous, you know. I say that my folks favored my brother.
Mm-hmm. First born in an Italian family.
Right. We grew up a little bit jealous of each other, you know, and then when he was about ready to go overseas, I met him at Tanforan Racetrack. That's where his camp was.
Mm-hmm.
And the last thing, I was 18 years old. He says, well, I took my mom up there. He said, I've got to go now. So the last thing that's embedded in my mind, he was going around the camp shack. And he waved, turned around and waved at me. That's the last impression I had of my brother at 18 years old.
Wow.
He went to northern India. He was a mechanic. He trained as a mechanic at Scorey Field here in North Visalia.
Mm.
So naturally, when he went to Air Force, he wanted to be a mechanic.
Mm-hmm.
So he was a mechanic on C-45s or 46s, flying the hump over to China. The time came when they had what they call R&R, English vehicle, Indian driver, in northern India. They ended up in a ravine, killed everyone but one. He was sitting in the back of the vehicle, and the story goes that as the vehicle went over the cliff, he got bounced out. And a few years later, he was from Massachusetts. He came and saw my folks, told them the story, what happened.
And if that gentleman hadn't survived, you guys probably never would have known what happened to your brother.
Nothing at all. I've searched through files, and I've never found a bit of information about that mishap.
So we're getting hit early on here with the gravity of World War II. Your brother was one of the more than 406,000 Americans who died in uniform during that time. And I'll come back around to that. I want to get a taste for your story, too. You mentioned him working on planes here in Visalia at Sequoia Fields,
where
the Army Air Corps was going hot and heavy. But it's your senior year at Visalia High School, the campus that now is Redwood High School. Your senior year, December 7th, happens.
That's right.
What do you remember about that day? How did you find out?
It was Sunday, and Visalia Times-Delta came out with a special that evening. I was working the service station, And that's how I heard about whatever happened to Hawaii.
Did that give you a bit of a jolt?
It did. Yeah, finally came to the light. I might, you know, I wasn't in the service then, but they really gathered up all the young guys, and boy, and you couldn't get out of it.
Mm-hmm.
I tried to get out of it.
You did? What'd you do?
I did.
How'd you try to get out of it?
Well, my folks needed help on the ranch.
Sure.
But it didn't happen. And in a way, it was a blessing. In a way, you know, I was in the service about 3 years, and when I came back, I remember my dad saying something like this to my mother. He went away as a child and came back as a man.
Mm.
So military service, sometimes you grow up pretty fast. I don't want to talk about controversy or anything, but some of these young men should go.
Because you went through some horrific things, but you're saying now you can look back and see what it did for you.
Exactly.
So you finish high school, graduate in 1942. How long until Uncle Sam got his hands on you?
6 months. I was going to COS. I just finished my first semester, got home that evening, and there was a letter. Your government wants you.
And your brother was already in?
Oh, yeah, he was in about a year or so. We were just 13 months apart.
How did your mother feel about both of you being in this war?
You know how it is, an Italian mother. Gold Star mother after...
Yeah, after Bert died.
Yeah. You know, for 40 years, it was always on her mind.
Mm.
And then as she got older and in her 80s, she was starting to forget about it. But for years, it really jolted her.
Well, I can believe it.
And the telegram came into Western Union that evening. And the girl that worked at Western Union knew my folks. And she didn't have the heart to bring that notice to my folks. So she found her brother. And he searched all over Visalia, all the Italian families. He finally found them where they were. The owner opened the door, and my folks could see the guy at the door. They knew exactly what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And they thought it was me because I was in Europe, where at that time it really jolted her. There again, I go back a few years being jealous about my brother, you know, and everything. I says, I hate to say this, but he was their favorite. It really hurt him.
Hmm.
And it took years for my mom, always looking out the window. I did see a movie one time that followed that same thing. This woman sat in her bedroom. She looked down a long driveway, waiting for her son to come back. And that's the same thing that happened to my mom. She was a gentle lady. This is going back to her. My dad passed away in 74. He was 76, and I took care of my mom for 21 years.
Hmm.
My dad wasn't so gentle. I kind of resented him. But now I look back, and I'm way past his age, and I feel guilty how I treated my dad. My mom was special to me. Okay, we'll move on. Next question, please.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Well, and I'm glad that you shared that with us, because it's instructive for us to know that when we hear something in a song or we see something in a movie, it's not just a cliche. It's not just something made up. Your mother was looking out the window waiting for the son that was never going to come home.
That's right.
And it made sense for her to expect it to be you, because you're
yes.
the one who is in the thick of these combat situations in Europe while your brother's a mechanic in the China-Burma-India theater. In theory, he's got the safe job.
Correct.
But it doesn't always work out that way. But I'm curious about for you, and we're going to talk about all your experiences in the Army. But when you got that news of what had happened to Bert, where were you and how did that strike you?
I was in France at the time, and also a chaplain came over to see me. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it. A good, safe place like that. But that's the luck of the draw. I miss him to this day. 1944 was kind of a rather sad year for me. My grandpa and grandmother passed away. My cousin passed away that year. My brother passed away that year. So going back to 1944, it was very sad.
And you were on Omaha Beach, the longest day of 1944.
That's correct.
We're going to talk about that, but I want to talk about when you first got into the Army. What did you expect they were going to have you do?
Well, I went to Monterey as usual. They cut your hair, put you on a train, troop train. I ended up at Cheyenne. If any folks are from Cheyenne, I feel sorry for you.
A little cold up there, huh?
It's cold. It's 40 below. Although that was good, I was because when I got over to Europe, 1944 was a real bad year for them folks. They talk about it. I was there last in 1999, and they were still talking about the year of 1944. It was a very, very cold drift where I would say at least 20 feet tall. We were ill-equipped. We didn't have galoshes, and I happened to find a pair, so that saved my feet.
You had us in Cheyenne, and that's where we got off on the horrible Battle of the Bulge-like weather here in the States. When did you start to figure out the kind of job you were going to have in the Army?
Oh, okay. After basic training, then you had to go technical training. And they, just because my record showed I worked in a service station, they wanted to make me a mechanic. Now, the mechanic was my brother, not I. So they gave me an old 32 Chevy engine. They said, I'll break this down to the last screw bolt on that engine, lay all the pieces on the floor. The inspectors are going to check off if I had removed everything off of it. Put it back together. And it wouldn't start. I tried, wouldn't start. So the runner came in, said, you're wanted at the office. So I went to the office. Says, good news. Seems like we can't make you a mechanic. There's an opening for a new company that's going to be formed. I was a buck private. And he told me, you'll jump from buck private to staff sergeant, $20 more a month. 20 bucks back in 44, that was a lot of money.
Yeah.
So I jumped at the chance. A few days later, we traveled over to Denver. I didn't know what I was going to expect. It was a training that if I survived this training, I'd have those stripes. So we went to a morgue, Denver General Hospital, seen an autopsy. People couldn't stand the sight. So naturally, they dropped out. I hung in there with the thought still of that 20 bucks. From there, we moved over to Portland, Oregon, seeing another autopsy. A man drowned in Columbia River. I hung in there, and they formed up the company. And they told us Graves Registration. I didn't know what was Graves Registration. From there, we moved over north of Boston, Massachusetts, and we shipped out of there in early April. It took us 14 days to get over to England. There was not a foot of empty land in England. There was equipment every square foot in England. So after a couple more months of training, we took off on June the 5th, got in the middle of the channel, had to return back. The weather was terrible, just terrible. So we spent the night there. Next morning, we took off on June 6th. I had one squad on that landing craft and a few extra men that I didn't know who they were. So we got to the edge of Normandy, and we were just circling around. Finally, a destroyer came after us. He says, they need that bulldozer on the beach. So that's why I landed on the beach on June the 6th, early afternoon. Spent the night soaking wet. Every inch of my body was wet. And spent the night there on the beach in an old German trench.
Let me ask you, before you left, and you mentioned you guys took off June 5th, got halfway there, had to turn around because of the weather. But before you even left, was there anything that suggested to you or gave you any indication of what you were going to be getting into?
Not really. Not really. But as soon as you got on the beach, you knew what had happened.
And what was it that you were expecting you guys were going to do? Did you have an assignment or a duty that you were looking forward to at that point?
At the time, I hate to talk about the early time there on the beach, but it was terrible. But it was a distraction to see a body on the beach, incoming troops. Those all had to be cleared out of the way, with my little squad. I want to mention my company was 607th Graves Registration Company, 3rd Platoon. There's four platoons in the company. I was a third. We landed there early afternoon.
I want to make sure I'm hearing you correctly. So as you're heading over, and you've got these men that you described, and you told us they told you you needed to go in because they needed the bulldozer.
Uh-huh.
So you know, before you even step ashore, your job is going to be taking care of guys who've been killed already.
Yes. Yes.
How did you feel about that?
I didn't think too much of it.
Yeah?
It was a job. You had to do it. But all these memories do come back. And they did come back 50 years later.
Because you went back physically.
That's right. For 50 years, my folks didn't know what I did.
Mm.
I never did tell them.
Wow.
They never asked, so I didn't say nothing. And I think that's mostly GIs did the same thing. I don't think they talked about the war to their folks.
It's been my experience just in interviewing hundreds of vets that most of them will say exactly what you're saying.
Yeah.
And the reasons they usually give are, one, I didn't want to be bragging about it.
Yeah.
Two, which I'm guessing applies in your case, there were so many who didn't come home.
That's right.
Including your own brother and all those guys you buried over there.
Absolutely.
But from the get-go, your first experience of war is clearing away dead bodies so more troops can come ashore?
Especially on a beach.
You just had to move them out of the way.
You had to pick them up.
And then what do you do with them?
We would have a special place. We had tents, put them in the tank. You had to keep them away from the eyes of incoming troops.
So you didn't want the guys coming in to see how many had already been killed?
No.
Wow.
Yeah.
So this is, in one way, logistical to make sure there's space for troops to come ashore and vehicles. And maybe even more importantly, this is a psychological move that you don't want guys to be thinking, hey, that's going to happen to me.
That's right.
So from the time you hit the beach, that's what you're doing.
Yeah, my men were doing.
I'm just trying to imagine what that feels like because you're...
And I was 20 years old.
Can 20 you imagine? Years old.
20 years old. I had 25 men with me, and that's what we did. Later on, as the battle moved on, some of those men were ordered to all emergency hospitals. They would tour those every day and pick up who didn't survive the day before. Some of the sites you can't talk about, even to this day. War is hell.
That's coming from someone who had to deal with the worst of it and was surrounded by death throughout his time in the Army. Vito Mastrangelo is our guest today. You'll find photos and videos of him at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. When we come back, we'll explore more of what Vito experienced on D-Day and beyond. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.